Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, Too Close to Call, 2 days after the American election. I've got that song, The Final Countdown, rolling through my brain right now, but there's still no clear winner. Lots of counting, lots of court challenges. Take a look at the banner along our screen just below me right now, showing Joe Biden still at 264 Electoral College votes to Donald Trump's 214. Remember, the magic number to win the White House is 270. So by this count, Joe Biden is very close. If he does win just one undecided state, he'll take the presidency. Though we should say some pollsters are not calling all the states that you've seen on our screen. The Trump camp is still fighting in a lot of those. But right now, all eyes are on Nevada, where the state's six Electoral College votes could hand Joe Biden a win. However, again, Donald Trump is leading in other swing states like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia. His lead in all these, though, has diminished dramatically in the last day as more mail-in ballots are counted, ballots that seem to favor Biden by a big majority. The former vice president just spoke, urging all ballots to be counted, urging patience. Let me show you just a bit of what he said a couple minutes ago.
Democracy is sometimes messy. It sometimes requires a little patience as well. But that patience has been rewarded now for more than 240 years with a system of governance that's been the envy of the world. And we continue to feel, Senator and I, we continue to feel very good about where things stand. We have no doubt that when the count is finished, Senator Harris and I will be declared the winners. The process is working. The count is being completed. And we'll know very soon.
Okay, we don't know when, and though the count is being completed, it's also being challenged. So how will all this be decided?
They continue to count illegal votes. That is unacceptable.
These are people who are not involved in voter fraud. These people are not involved in voter suppression. I'm telling you, they're doing their jobs every day. It is hard.
Okay, so the first person there was the Trump campaign alleging fraud. Then there, the people in Georgia saying everyone's just doing it properly. But again, the president is pushing to halt counts and discredit ballots. When will we finally get a result? In moments, we're going to go to CTV's Tom Walters. In western U.S., he's been watching states like Arizona and Nevada critically. Richard Madden at the Biden camp in Delaware. But also on the program today, pandemic budget blowout. Check this out.
We will do whatever it takes to protect and support the people of Ontario today, tomorrow, and every day.
Well, again, you know, there's
Ontario delivers a massive $187 billion pandemic budget. What's the plan in Canada's biggest province? Where is the money getting spent? We did ask for the Ontario Finance Minister, Rod Phillips. He was unavailable right now. We will get reaction from the Ontario opposition leader, NDP leader, Andrea Horvath. All right, lots to come. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So there are just a handful of states left in the race for the White House. Joe Biden is close to unseating Donald Trump in this bitter battle, but there's no guarantee. Will we get an answer today, tomorrow, by the end of the week? What are the pathways that either candidate has to victory? Let's begin our coverage tonight with CTV News' Tom Walters and CTV News Washington correspondent Richard Madden. He's in Delaware. Tom is in Los Angeles. Rich, let me just start with you. Obviously, Joe Biden just spoke. They believe they're on the cusp of winning. Where do they think right now they can clinch this?
Yeah, they're feeling very good about Nevada. As a matter of fact, I asked Joe Biden yesterday if he thought he could win Nevada. He unequivocally said yes. He was also asked if he what his prospects were in Pennsylvania, and he said, I'm hopeful. So remember, if Biden wins Nevada, if he clinches Nevada, that six Electoral College votes, that gets him to 270 on the nose, game over for Donald Trump. And in another sign of confidence by the Biden camp, they've already set up a website. Their transition team is in place showing that. And just about an hour and a half ago, I don't know if you can see it from our angle, but they have set up a podium back on the stage with protective glass. They were doing mic checks, sound checks. So it has a feeling that perhaps there might be something tonight if Joe Biden does speak, because they've already set things up for that event. So if he wins Nevada, it's game over. Pennsylvania, of course, is one we're watching. Biden doesn't need Pennsylvania if he holds on to Arizona and if he wins Nevada. But we're expecting to get an update from Pennsylvania within the hour. And again, if Pennsylvania goes to Biden, then it's also game over. Donald Trump's victory becomes narrower and narrower. Trump needs to run the board of the remaining states, including Pennsylvania. North Carolina is looking good for him, but Georgia, the margins are so tight. We're already hearing Trump advisors saying they are worried of their prospects in Georgia. They did not see that one coming. So again, to quote Joe Biden, this is messy, but it's democracy. Biden is urging patience, but he is in a much better position right now than Donald Trump.
Okay, so let's watch some of those states and go over to you, Tom. Biden says he's closing in. They're putting Arizona in the bag. It's being contested, by the way, by Donald Trump and his supporters. Trump has launched a bouquet of lawsuits. What is the Trump camp's view now, and what's their strategy, Tom?
Well, they seem to have taken up permanent residency in the alternate universe where there is massive voter fraud going on. They're filing lawsuits, some of which are marginal at best, and some of which, as perhaps a measure of how concerned they are, I mean, they're in one case, one of their lawsuits involves what I think amounts to a total of 93 ballots in Pennsylvania. They're going to have real trouble with most of these lawsuits, as one of the law professors at Loyola University here in Los Angeles says, a lawsuit without facts is a tweet with a filing fee. To sort of pin their hopes on that, on really trying to prevent further vote counting, is a strategy sort of disenfranchisement, but it's also a strategy that flows out of this claim that Trump has been making for years, really. I mean, it started before the 2016 election when he started saying that, the only way he could lose is if the vote was rigged. Well, he won. So, I mean, it's almost from the outset he disproved his own claims about widespread fraud. But when it turned out that Hillary Clinton had won the popular vote by 3 million, then suddenly he's talking about there being 3 million fraudulently cast votes. He finds a like-minded conspiracy theorist, sets up a presidential commission to investigate voter fraud. It sort of vanishes in the night with nothing ever found. And in the lead up to this election, one of the lawsuits filed by the Trump campaign was in Pennsylvania to try and block the use of these drop boxes for dropping off of ballots. And it was thrown out for lack of evidence of any kind of voter fraud, thrown out by a judge that Donald Trump appointed. So this is now what they're down to, is sort of clinging to this voter fraud mythology in spite of all of the problems there are with that longstanding claim.
Right. But Richard, look, it's perfectly in every candidate's right to launch a legal challenge. What's unique here is the allegations of mass voter fraud, and certainly the allegation that already they've won the election, or that votes need to stop counting. That's different. But Rich, is the Biden camp lawyered up to counter this? I mean, could it be decided before these legal fights, or are we just going to watch the Biden lawyers versus the Trump lawyers, and this is sort of Bush-Gore all over again?
Yeah, well, this could be Bush-Gore times three, right? Because Bush-Gore was Florida, but Biden's team have lawyered up. It's reported that they have 4,000 lawyers on standby. They were waiting for this, and it's no secret, no surprise that this would happen. Trump has been channeling this since the summer, insisting that you can't rely on the post office, insisting there is widespread voter fraud when you use a mail-in ballot, saying this, of course, without any clear evidence. So Team Biden, they have lawyered up, and they were expecting these legal fights in Michigan and in Wisconsin. And as you noted, Trump has every right to ask for a recount or to question these results. Absolutely, 100%. The difference is that in 2016, when Trump won Michigan by a razor-thin amount of votes, Hillary Clinton did not challenge that. But this time, when Trump is down 10,000-some votes or whatever it's at now, that Trump is going to be challenging that, asking for a recount. So this is going to be messy. It's going to be ugly. And it could likely delay the certification of the election. But once these votes are tabulated state by state, that really kind of sets the stage for things to come down the line.
Yeah, convention would say that someone at that point would concede the way, let's say, George W. Bush at one point did to Bill Clinton. But, Tom, you've been watching Arizona and especially Nevada, all eyes on Nevada, as Rich just said. Just dig in. What are we watching for in those? Is Arizona gone? Because the Trump folks don't believe so. And what are we watching for in Nevada, places you've been watching real close?
Well, in Nevada, we're, you know, it's just a matter of time to get through the remaining vote count, and that could be a day or two yet. But the other thing, you know, you mentioned Arizona. That's been a really interesting story because some news agencies have called Arizona for Donald Trump or for Joe Biden, I should say. And what we've seen there is the pattern of, you know, the latest votes to be counted, the last votes to be counted are these mail-in and absentee ballots. And in a lot of states, there's been an assumption, and it's borne out by fact, that they tilt toward the Democrat. In Arizona, it's not as clear cut. There's a large absentee vote in Arizona, and a lot of those are people who, you know, who live in other states, have places in Arizona, may choose to be voters in Arizona. They are voters. They are Arizona residents for the purpose of the election, but are you know, casting absentee ballots, and they skew Republican. So it's not as clear cut that these last votes to count will tilt toward the Democrats. So, you know, so there is more room. There is a little bit more wiggle room there for Donald Trump to close that gap. It's not out of the realm of possibility. And that's why there are different calls around Arizona.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure people appreciate that because people, yeah. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in here because we're already looking at the map right now with the election, but you can already guess and get a sense of where things are going by what is happening now. You have Eric Trump and Don Jr. Tweeting furious at Republicans who are staying silent, not supporting their dad in that fight, saying, you know, where are you, Republicans? Stand up for our father. Our voters will remember this. So, you know, that can be taken as an indicator of the nervousness with Team Trump. Whereas Joe Biden today, he held his a coronavirus briefing. So that's a signal that Biden is already looking beyond the presidency into governing, along with his new transition website that he's launched. So I think you're starting to see two storylines play out as we enter the final stretch of this election counting.
Yeah, and Tom and Richard, great reporting as usual. I just the reason I wanted Tom to explain that, you're seeing some Trump supporters in Arizona saying count the votes, and Donald Trump tweeting out don't count the votes in other states, and that's probably you get the different messaging. All right, Tom Walters in California and Los Angeles and in Delaware, Richard Madden, as usual, gents, fantastic work. Now, as Richard and Tom were saying, if Joe Biden is inching closer to the presidency, and that certainly is what the votes are looking like, the Trump campaign is coming out in full force in those undecided states, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, Nevada, Pennsylvania, claiming massive voter fraud. It has erupted into a stop the count protest in most of them except Arizona, where it's keep counting. Is it sour grapes? Is there a legitimate grounds? Is there any evidence? I'm going to bring in the former White House speechwriter for President George W. Bush and the National Tea Party Movement leader, Michael Johns, a Trump supporter. Great to have you, Mr. Johns, on the program. A lot of folks are saying, you know, it's legitimate to challenge. Absolutely, it's in Donald Trump's right to challenge. But he has alleged massive voter fraud, and it's very difficult to see any actual evidence of that in these states. What is the evidence that these states are being stolen?
Well, I think that's one of the things that's been very perplexing to many of us who've been on the Trump side, is to hear in media establishment and also in among Democrats that there's no history of voter fraud in this country. There's an extraordinary history of voter fraud. And those who think there isn't ought to put the bail up for the many people that are in jail for precisely that offense, particularly with mail-in ballots. And that's been, you know, one of the concerns that we've had as it related to this campaign and the disproportionate number that obviously have been submitted in various states. The election is close. I concede, I think everyone concedes on the Electoral College count vote right now that Joe Biden has a lead. But a back of the envelope math shows, you know, President Trump with 214 confirmed Electoral College votes right now by my math. If you put Georgia in there at 16, North Carolina at 15, Pennsylvania at 20, and Arizona at 11, which I acknowledge are big assumptions and far from concluded and legal battles to come. But he is winning in Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, although Pennsylvania has an extraordinary number of outstanding ballots. That would put him over 270. By my math. So there is a map there.
Yeah, listen, I agree. Is there a path? For sure. No one's saying he's got to run the table. He's got it, and he'll win 270. Let me just return to the first question, though. nobody has doubted that there has been examples of voter fraud in the past. But the president has alleged that there's massive voter fraud now in Pennsylvania, in Nevada, in Georgia. And again, he's in every right to make challenges, but there has been no evidence of that in this particular election on the scale he's talking about at all. What do you make of that? Is it reckless of the president to already say that this process is not to be trusted right now, and as he's done, to declare victory or say stop the count?
I think it's complicated for him to communicate all these things. If you're really looking for the definitive source, it's going to be in the court filings to read the actual complaints that specify what the allegations are and what the court will be asked upon to rule. These will be likely in federal circuit courts. If Trump doesn't prevail, they'll likely be appealed to the Supreme Court. And I think the Supreme Court will be obligated to hear that, given that it's a presidential election, presuming frivolous nature to the complaints. It's very clear, look, in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania generally, there are, essentially an arbitrary extension by the court of ballot deadlines by 72 hours. I mean, the court just kind of took the liberty on their own of saying that they thought that was a reasonable thing to do, which is one of the concerns many of us have about judicial activism in this country. That's not the role of the court to do that. These are guided by statutes and by state electoral guidelines. And, in that case, I'm pretty confident that those are going to be discounted. Now, there was a case in Pennsylvania also as it relates to voter observation. Almost every state provides some provision to allow the campaign to oversee the counting of votes. The allegation in Pennsylvania and some other states is that that was denied them. And even where those cases are being won, however, it's like tough to identify what the retroactive remedy is, because it's like, okay, you have to allow them in, but that's helpful going forward. But you already have had, obviously votes that have been counted. And then outrageously, Philadelphia, it closed down their counting Tuesday night when they could have, for what reason would you possibly do that? And today in Allegheny County, where there's only in Pennsylvania, where there's only 35,000 remaining ballots to be counted, they've taken the day off to do administrative work. These are
I understand that. That is weird, and none of us can understand that. But that taking the day off and the slow count isn't necessarily any sign of fraud. Okay, but just real quick, because I got about 30 seconds here. I don't know how this is going to go, but let's say Nevada declares for Biden. Now, and Arizona does. He goes over the top. Do you think Donald Trump accepts that and there's a peaceful transition, or what happens in that situation with his supporters?
Yeah, I think there's an inclination to want to depict that the president's not committed to the peaceful transfer of power. And the reality of political leadership, as opposed to maybe having a little bit of distance from it, is, it's not a very politically convenient message to communicate. But there is no doubt that if this president exhausts his legal remedies and loses this election in a way that is acceptable and where appeals have been exhausted, that there'll be a peaceful transfer of power. And I say that as someone who's been a very, very consistent and loyal supporter of the president from day one, by the way, in 2015, that would even be my position. The system and the process of constitutional democracy, above all else, has to be defended.
Right.
And I don't think this president would suggest otherwise if he weren't in the situation that he's in. There are legitimate and serious issues in a number of these states. And in the case of Philadelphia, unfortunately, they have a long history. There's a congressman in jail for fraud there. Long history of problems in the process.
All right. Well, listen, I got to leave it there, Mr. Johns, but we'll see what happens. Obviously, the long history. I don't know if that's going to necessarily inform what we're doing now, but we'll find out what the threshold is to accept all this. Mr. Johns, great to have you on the program, sir. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
All right. In the midst of all the focus on the United States, a very, very big news budget here in Canada. The biggest province, Ontario, tables their budget. The Ontario Finance Minister, Rod Phillips, tabled the budget today, the first budget since COVID-19. Ontario is now staring at nearly $40 billion deficit this year, up to $100 billion deficit in spending over 3 years. The province offers up a plan to deal with the cost of the pandemic. And I'll just show you some highlights. The Ontario budget table today is $187 billion. That's massive. That's $45 billion directly going to pandemic spending, including healthcare spending, support for parents, and tax cuts for businesses. Here are some details. $6 billion for COVID funding through 2023. $383 million for families before the end of the year. That's about $200 to $250 per child before the holiday season. Businesses, they'll get a tax cut. They'll see a reduction in electricity rates. There's also a seniors tax credit, up to 25% of home renovation, up to $10,000. There's even credit to take a vacation inside Ontario. Is all this the right step? It's a lot of money, but are the priorities right? What about, I don't know, long-term care homes? We're going to get reaction again. We did ask for Rod Phillips. He's usually available, was not able to make the program today. But for reaction, we'll get the official opposition. The Ontario NDP leader, Andrea Horvath, joins us. Great to have you. Hope the family's doing well. Andrea Horvath, your reaction. It's a big budget. It blows through the Conservatives' promise to have a balance. That's the way the world's been since the pandemic. What do you make of how they're spending all this money?
Well, Evan, I'm glad to be here to talk about it, to be honest with you, because I was shocked to see this budget. I was shocked to see that what looks like Mr. Ford and Mr. Phillips and the Conservative team have basically, you know, thrown in the towel on the fight against COVID-19. You know, there's no new expenditures for things like public health, for things like hospitals, for things like, you know, getting class sizes down. The idea that we're not funding for the 4 hours of hands-on care for long-term care is, you know, it's worse than disappointing. It's absolutely, it's callous, and it's the wrong thing to do. This should have been the government's opportunity to start, you know, helping people. There's no direct supports for small business. You know, so you talked about tax tax rebates and things like that. But like, if you're not, you know, if you're boarding up your windows now, a reduction in hydro sometime in the future is not going to help you, nor will a tax cut or a tax credit. People need help, particularly small business and medium-sized business that's direct, that helps them pay their rent, helps them keep people on payroll.
But hold on. There is money going to healthcare, first of all, as you know. There's healthcare spending in this budget. There's over $45 billion. There's COVID, and that's the $6 billion for COVID funding. There's also help for families, that's $383 million, so they're going to get a check.
I think it's really clear that they're not actually increasing, you know, appropriately the base funding for hospitals. So you know, what we heard from the financial accountability officer is that in fact they're sitting on most of that COVID spending. They're sitting on $9 billion, so they might have it in their budget, they're not spending it, and that's a problem. The hospitals now are operating with about $850 million of accumulated complete, when you add them all up, deficits, because the government's not flowing them the money. So now they're digging into their capital budgets to try to pay their operating costs because the government's sitting on the money. That's really, really troubling. New public health staff. I mean, it's a public health emergency. It's a pandemic that we're in, and there's no increased spending on public health. It makes no sense. I mean,
A couple days ago they'd spent $116 million to create hundreds of new hospital beds.
Well, again, what they're doing is
hold on, Andrea Horvath, hang on. Can you hold on for a second? I got to go to we got breaking news out of Pennsylvania. There could be a big vote count decision here. Let me just go to Pennsylvania. That's Andrea Horvath. Thanks for understanding here. Let me go to there, and I want to return to the Ontario budget. Let's jump to Pennsylvania.
We have, we've been reaching out, we've been very closely in touch with all 67 counties, making sure that they're reporting on as regular basis as possible. I know all of you, everybody around the country, around the state are eagerly awaiting, and I can tell you the counties are too. They are every single voter in the Commonwealth who has cast their ballot is having those ballots accurately and securely counted. So, you know, as you know, we're going to keep counting military and overseas ballots, I think, are coming in. Those will continue to be accepted through next Tuesday. There are obviously provisional ballots that will have to be counted as well after the initial round of ballots. And, you know, I think whatever the outcomes are, I can tell you that I'm so proud to work with the 67 counties, the election officials who are just doing an amazing job getting these counted accurately and securely. So I am happy, I think, with that to take your questions. Yes.
The integrity of the election has certainly been questioned quite a bit over the past several days, and it seems to be intensifying now in these final states that we're waiting to hear from. What is your message to people doing things work here in Pennsylvania?
So, you know, as we've been talking about for months, Pennsylvanians have more choices on how they've been able to vote this year than they've ever had in the history of the Commonwealth. And no matter how they voted, what's critical here is that we have very strong processes in place. Are constantly followed by every county in the state. So, for example, we talked about, I think it was yesterday, voting by mail in Pennsylvania. So the process is, though it's new under Act 77 that we can all vote by mail, it's the same processes that we've used for decades for absentee voting. So voters have to apply. They're checked against either Social Security database or the PennDOT database. They're checked against their voter record to make sure that they're a qualified voter and they are who they say they are. They cast their ballot. There's really like the strength of the integrity of this vote is really unparalleled. Same when you vote in person, right? You have to be registered, you go in, you sign in the poll book. All these things are tracked. Our voting systems and our databases make sure no voter can cast more than one vote. It literally has a hard stop should anybody even try. And the counties, again, as I've talked about, the amazing county election officials, they take this so seriously. They are such professionals. So, you know, I can just say, really, no matter how you chose to vote this year, and so many Pennsylvanians have, and it looks like it's really going to be great turnout when we finalize the numbers, that every method is incredibly safe and secure. Yes.
Hey, you've said, if I understand it correctly, that enough results may be coming in tonight for people to have a handle on who the winner in the presidential race is. What's your basis for thinking that? Can you put a finer point on it? How long? What makes you say that?
So the counties are continuing to count. And so obviously, depending on how close the race is, that impacts whether you – so you know – The final results are not certified until 20. The final results are not certified until 20 days after the election, right? So I want to be clear, there's no final results happening now anyway. What's happening now is having enough ballots counted to actually see who the winner is, right? The farther apart that is, the easier it is to tell. So it's very close in Pennsylvania, right? There's no question. And so that means it's going to take longer to actually see who the winner is. But I can tell you that there's several hundred thousand ballots remaining to be counted. You can track all that, what counties it remains in, look at our website, and you'll be able to see how we get to the conclusion. But, you know, either way, I want to be clear that these are just the mail-in and absentee votes and the in-person votes, right? The overwhelming majority, like, I think, you know, a huge, huge majority of the in-person votes have been counted. We're in a very good place with the mail-in and absentee ballots, but not quite there yet. But then there's still going to be provisional ballots, the military and overseas ballots, and so forth. So the closer the race is, the longer it takes. But I think what I've said all along is that the overwhelming majority of ballots will be counted by Friday. I still think that we're ahead of the schedule, and we actually already have counted the overwhelming majority of ballots, but because it's a close race, it's not quite clear yet who the winner is. So, yes.
You've mentioned provisional ballots a couple of times. How many of those have been cast statewide? And of those, how many have been counted and reported?
So very few have been counted, and because the that usually happens following the counting of the other ballots. So usually, so that you won't see, counties are not going to start that until after they've finished with the others generally. So we don't know yet. We've been reaching out to the counties. I know, I can't remember if it was you or somebody else who asked me both about provisional ballot numbers and numbers of ballots arriving after Election Day, after 8 p.m. on Election Day. So provisional ballots, you know, I think we've heard from, you know, maybe two-thirds of the counties. So I don't have a firm number yet, and as soon as we do, we'll be able to report those numbers.
Can you give me your best estimate?
The provisional ballots, I think it's still early yet. So let's touch base again after I have more than the number that I have so far. Yeah.
No guesstimate at all?
It doesn't, you know, the context matters, right? So if I tell you a number that reflects 41 counties, it could be not reflective of the whole because it matters which counties they are. So we will circle back with you. Yes.
I know that you stand by the integrity of the election so far. Have you or any of the counties investigated any specific allegations of voter fraud?
No. I mean, I'm not aware of any. I mean, well, I should say you probably heard some weeks ago that there was a gentleman in Luzerne County who tried to apply for a ballot for his deceased mother. I don't know if you heard that, but that was several weeks ago. That was the only incident that I am aware of in this year. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I know that you said a minute ago that you guys have counted the vast majority of the in-person Election Day votes. Can you give us a more specific sense of how many of those are outstanding? Is it fewer than the remaining mail-in votes?
Oh, yeah. If you go to our website and the supplemental dashboard, if you look at, like, the pie chart, it's a tiny sliver. It may be that 99% are counted. So it just, but I, whether it's 99 or 98.5, go to the dashboard and it will tell you.
More beyond the mail-in ballots that are.
No, I mean, there's a tiny fraction of precincts that aren't counted yet. Yeah, it's a very, very, very small number. Yeah. Yes.
The outstanding mail-in ballots, does that include counties that have all counties segregated the ballots that came in after Election Day?
Right. So the ballots that have been counted so far are the ones that came in by November 3rd. So, and all the counties are going to be segregating any that came in after 8 p.m. on November 3rd through 5 p.m. on November 6th. Yes. Yes, Dennis.
Secretary, there are 7 precincts in Allegheny County that aren't reporting anything yet. That includes Election Day in-person ballots. Do you know what's going on there?
No, I don't, but I'm happy to check with them afterwards. I know what's going on in some of the other things, but I don't know what's going on in those 7 precincts. So thank you. We will reach out to them. Yes.
Does the department know how many mail-in ballots might still be en route to election offices that were postmarked by the 3rd?
Do we know how many are en route? No. You know, I could tell you that the numbers that have come in so far are a tiny fraction of what came in after the primary. So I don't think, and usually, I mean, based on historical numbers, you get the most ballots, you know, the day after Election Day, and then it dwindles from there. So I think, I don't expect it to be a significant amount.
Got the board, right? You got the board.
Surrendered at the polls on November 3rd?
Not yet. We will know that because the we will know.
All right, guys, you've been listening to an update from Pennsylvania. Obviously, this is a critical state. There is a path for Joe Biden to win without Pennsylvania if he wins, you know, Arizona and Nevada. But Pennsylvania is critical for Donald Trump, and it's a huge state, obviously, from the Electoral College. But here are the numbers right now. The lead is 90,566 votes for Donald Trump. With close to 90% of the polls reporting. So he's got just over 90,000. Now, again, that sounds like a lot, but there's lots of votes that Biden thinks he can catch up. But again, he doesn't need that state necessarily for his path. Donald Trump does. There's no path to victory for Donald Trump without Pennsylvania. So this is a very big state. There is a path, although a narrower one, for Joe Biden, but he can, you know, if he does win Arizona and Nevada, and Michigan, he's done. He can win. So, but still, Pennsylvania is very key. But again, we're just 2 days past Election Day, and lots of counting going on. There's still no decision. Despite all these allegations of fraud, I should say, and I've said this before, this is the process. This is not partisan. It's not Republican or Democrat. Votes have to be counted in a close race. There's millions of mail-in ballots because of COVID, tens of millions more than ever, and so it takes more time. And just to be clear, as I've said, the Donald Trump camp has every right to launch legal challenges if they believe so. Maybe they're spurious, maybe they're not. But the system allows for legal challenges. What is unusual and deeply troubling to many people is the lack of evidence of voter fraud, the allegations that the entire election is fraudulent, or as he tweeted out today, that the vote should not be counted. The Biden camp, as you saw, believes more ballots will be counted and they'll hit that magic number of 270, which is the winning threshold. What would a Biden presidency, and it's looking closer, no guarantee, mean for Canada? Has the U.S. been permanently changed by the last 4 years? Let me bring in the press gallery right now. Joyce Napier is the CTV News Washington Bureau Chief, Ottawa Bureau Chief, but she used to be reporting from Washington, so she knows it well. I watch Washington and Ottawa. Joyce knows the capitals, trust me. Jamil Giovanni is the host tonight with the Jamil Giovanni News Talk at 10:10. He's always great to have on. And our special guest is also a guy that knows Washington, the former Canadian ambassador to the U.S., Frank McKenna. Great to have all of you here. I'll still call you Ambassador McKenna in deference to your former position as they do in the United States. But Ambassador Frank McKenna, if Joe Biden wins, and again, there's no guarantee, but what are the challenges he might pose for Canada?
Well, a lot of this is going to depend on the Senate configuration, as you know, because the Senate determines a lot of the policy that would affect Canada and the United States. To start with the good side of it, there'd probably be a very civil tone at the top. We would have some very sympathetic togetherness on climate change issues. Our energy sector would tend to be less competitively disadvantaged because south of the border, they might have many of the same types of programs. Keystone XL would be challenged because the presidential permit could be revoked. So there'd be a wide variety of different issues facing us. Even with Democrats, there have always been lots of pucks in the net, and you have to be vigilant. But certainly the tone would be dramatically different. And I think that we would win large if the United States reverts to its traditional support of multilateral institutions that matter a lot to Canada. I'm talking about things like WHO, WTO, Paris Accords, et cetera. That's very important to a middling country like Canada. So that would be really important.
Yeah, okay, let me go to Joyce. It's true, some of those international norms and institutions that Donald Trump has run down, maybe they would be buffered by Joe Biden, who said, for example, he'd rejoin Paris. But he's a Buy American guy, Democrats are. There's still gonna be a Republican Senate no matter what. Joyce, so you know, it's not like it's going to be a big kumbaya session under Joe Biden. What are the challenges there?
Well, the challenge is indeed, if the Senate stays Republican, then, you know, he will be a little bit of a paralyzed president. That is the way the American system works. But I think, you know, Ambassador McKenna was talking about a tone. The tone with Canada will change. I think the tone within the United States will change as well. I'm going to take you back very quickly to 2004. A senator from Illinois gave a speech at the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, and said, it was straight out of an Aaron Sorkin script, that there was no blue states or red states. There was the United States of America. And, you know, that was a big kumbaya moment. 4 years later, he did become president. And, you know, when we went to these inaugurations, whether it was George W. Bush in 2004 or Obama in 2008, there were Republicans and Democrats celebrating their president. So I don't know if this time we can put the toothpaste back in the tube and all these people that are armed and that are protesting in front of these places where there are recounts, where they're counting actually legitimate votes, it seems, will they be able? But I think that the tone, I like to be optimistic, and I think that the tone and the pressure will come down after all this is said and done and the dust settles. The relationship with Canada will also be a lot easier, although they don't see eye to eye. And yes, the Democrats are traditionally more protectionist.
Yeah, Jamil, let me bring you in. I don't know, again, we're not predicting here. There's a chance Donald Trump wins. And I should say the CTV system, the AP system, has called Arizona for Joe Biden. I know it's being challenged by Trump. But even if Donald Trump doesn't win, Trumpism is probably here to stay. It's a, as Joy said, it's a very polarized situation. We in Canada call it the two solitudes. We used to call that with Quebec and the English Canada. They've got their own two solitudes. They're blue and red right now. But will Trumpism change conservatism, and could that echo into Canada, Jamil?
Well, depends on what parts of Trumpism we talk about, because some people, when they hear that, they think about the anti-immigration element. They think about the harsh tones, as we're talking about now. They think about someone who's insensitive to the point of being disrespectful to large groups of people. But there are other parts of Trumpism, like his focus on the working class, like getting a large margin of voters who are unionized workers from Ohio, getting Latinos in Florida, a working class Hispanic county in Texas, Zapata County, supporting him. Those elements of Trumpism that speak to working class people of all different backgrounds and different economic situations, that might be the positive legacy of Trump should he be gone. And my hope is that there will be Republicans and also conservatives in other countries that might learn from that particular part of Trumpism and abandon the rest.
Frank McKenna, weigh in on that. I'm intrigued by these shifting coalitions and alliances.
Yeah, well, to start with, let me endorse what Joyce Napier just said. It's hard to know whether Humpty Dumpty can be put back together again in the United States. But if anybody can cross political boundaries, it's Joe Biden. It's just the nature of his personality. He's old school. There's a chance that he may be a Ronald Reagan healing type of figure. If he does nothing else, that would be a great accomplishment. We'll see. But I also agree, we don't know which Republican Party will show up after Donald Trump has left, if he leaves. Is it the old Republican Party that believes in fiscal austerity, not running up large deficits, doesn't believe in protectionism, for example? I don't think so. I think there'll be elements of Donald Trump that will linger around. And I do think that we're at peril if there's a major fiscal stimulus program, as there needs to be. Quite frankly, I think we'll be at some peril in terms of Buy American provisions that both parties will likely endorse. So we're going to have to be on our game, which we will be, in order to try to protect ourselves against that.
Joyce, I think there's a period that we're underestimating, and Donald Trump is clear. I don't know what the outcome will be, but Donald Trump is clearly ready not to accept it. You're not going to see, you know, a John McCain, I concede, a George W. Bush, I concede, right? These kind of speeches that we've come to see in the norm, Donald Trump has said, you know, losing's hard for me. He's already said this whole thing's a fraud. His kids are saying his whole thing's a fraud. If he loses, and this two-month interregnum period when the next president is sworn in, is there a real expectation of instability in the United States, and what long-term corrosive effects could that have?
Well, he still remains the president of the United States until January, until he leaves the White House, and if he loses, and the other president comes in. So, you know, can he do damage then? Perhaps. But, you know, at that point, it will be only words. The thing is, will he stoke those people that are now on the streets with their weapons and protesting and chanting stop the vote? That is the real unknown. But I am looking towards American institutions like the courts, like the Supreme Court, like Congress. They have solid institutions. I know that we're looking at Donald Trump and thinking that all, you know, après moi le déluge, as we say in French, after me, come what may. But there are institutions, there are protections here. And if the president doesn't want to leave, well, he will be shown the door. And we know the military has already said, yeah, we do not intervene. This is not our business. It is the business of the courts and of Congress. And they will do what they have to do. These institutions are very solid. And it takes more than one man, I think, and I hope, actually, to bring them down.
Yeah, Jamil, just real quick, any thoughts about potential long-term impacts on the kind of the dangerous rhetoric we see coming out of this election and the allegations, maybe the loss of trust? What do you think could be the long-term impact there, Jamil?
I think it's definitely a concern that there would be degradation of institutions to the point where people will not trust them. And this is partly why I think it's very important that we think about how ideological and political a lot of institutions have become, because people should be able to trust that there is a nonpartisan perspective they can turn to. And unfortunately, with a lot of media, with big tech, it feels like everything is partisan, everything is political, and we don't know where to get honest, straightforward, accurate information sometimes.
Yeah, okay, guys, let me take a break. I want to continue this conversation. We are awaiting an update from Georgia, another one of these key battleground states where votes are being challenged. So hang in there. If we go get Georgia, we'll go live. I want to keep the press gallery. We'll take a quick break. And again, there's lots of issues, political issues, that Canadian politicians have to deal with. And in the meantime, remember, there's a huge budget in Ontario. It's not all about the United States. Lots of politics going on here as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. You know, there's an old saying, there's gridlock in Washington. Nothing can get done because the Democrats and the Republicans don't get along. Well, they've got national gridlock right now in their election. They 2 days later, they cannot decide the result of the November 3rd presidential election. There's lawsuits, there's allegations, there's counting going on. But in the meantime, for Canadians, any form of instability in the United States, any form of gridlock in the United States means their economy will have trouble getting off the ground, and that affects our economy. What could it mean going forward, even if Joe Biden wins? There's a Republican Senate. They could have even deeper gridlock. Let's bring back the press gallery. Joyce Napier from CTV News. By the way, she used to spend a long time in Washington. She knows that city and that country well. Jamil Giovanni, the host of the great new show, Jamil Giovanni on News Talk 1010. And our special guest is the former Canadian ambassador to the U.S. and the former premier, Frank McKenna. Great to have you all back. Frank McKenna, look, you've been in the United States in these times of transition. Chaos in the United States is not good for their economy, our economy, the global economy. Gridlock in the United States, added with this global pandemic and the economic disaster it's been, makes it more difficult. Does instability in the United States have long-term economic warning signals for Canada?
I think there's a bit of a difference between instability and gridlock. If you look at the stock market over the last two or three days, they're pricing in gridlock, and they've been on jet fuel. The markets want the kind of situation that seems to be developing. Look, I have to tell you a quick anecdote. When I was ambassador, I wasn't a very good ambassador at the best of times, but I made a mistake, I guess it was, in a speech I gave in Canada, crowing about the Canadian political system, comparing it to the U.S., which I said was somewhat dysfunctional. I got reamed out by everybody that mattered in Canada, was forced to grovel and apologize, etc. I got down to the United States the next day, back to the embassy, and I was greeted like a hero. People said, thank you. Thank you for stating it the way it is. We like gridlock. Our system is designed for gridlock. And the private economy is motoring along. And their view is the less government, the better. So I don't like instability. I don't like the toxicity of the debates that are taking place. But that's extraneous to the fact that we might have gridlock in Congress.
Yeah, I'm going to use a Frank McKenna expression, which you once used to a U.S. ambassador. I'm not here to blow bubbles in your face. McKenna never blew bubbles in anybody's face. Do you remember that, Frank McKenna? That was a pretty tough moment as well. Man, yeah. you diplomacy was interesting. But let me just go to Joyce on that. Joyce, one of the reasons I'm talking about this is they need stimulus. Like Ontario had a massive budget today. Because the pandemic requires massive supports. In the United States, that might be delayed by all this. What could happen there, and what could the long-term impacts on their economy be if there's delayed with their support?
Well, there will be delays. I mean, what is happening now, and I agree with Frank McKenna, what's happening now is one thing. The dust will settle. And on the 20th of January, there will be either the old president or a new president, because we really don't know exactly if Biden will win. That will settle. But this has been the way Washington has functioned or dysfunctioned for decades. If a president is a Democrat and the Congress is Republican, there will be fights, and they're nasty fights, and they're fights that bring their budget to the brink. And, you know, there was government threats of government shutdowns on a regular basis when Obama was president because the Republicans wouldn't want to approve the budget. But now we're in a pandemic. And I don't know if that will be, if they will punish. And look, there will be another election in 2 years for Congress, a congressional election. And nobody wants to lose that. And the Republicans won't want to lose the Senate. So, you know, there will be probably some give and take, some good negotiations. But just remember this, Joe Biden was a senator and he understands the way the Senate functions and he even understands how it dysfunctions. So, you know, if anybody can deal with them, he's the man.
Yeah, maybe. Let me just quickly go to domestic issues in Ontario. The progressive conservative government there, as we talked about earlier, Jamil, released a big budget. And boy, does the pandemic ever flip this? I mean, here's a government that promised a balanced budget, massive deficits there. What does that tell you about what we should be expecting, Jamil? Just your early reaction to that budget.
Well, I think it means that when governing during a pandemic, you've got to take ideology and you've got to take dogma to the side and really think about what's necessary to save lives right away, whether that's from a health perspective or a jobs perspective. You've got to act with urgency. And I think it's great that we've seen, for example, collaboration between Premier Ford and Prime Minister Trudeau, collaboration between Premier Ford and Minister Freeland. Could you imagine Donald Trump and Andrew Cuomo appearing together at a press conference? I mean, to underscore the point that I would agree with the ambassador, have a much more functional political system, and this budget is a reflection of that.
Guys, I should just tell you, we've just got word Donald Trump is going to speak live at the White House at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Donald Trump speaking at the White House in just over a half an hour's time, 6:30 p.m., that's fascinating. We'll find out what he says. Guys, I got to leave it there. Joyce, Jamil, and Frank McKenna, great to have you. But don't budge, everybody, because we'll find out what the president says. Is it going to be a message of challenge, of fraud, of will it be calm? This is going to be a very important speech from the White House. Joe Biden spoke about an hour and a bit ago. It was very calm. So lock it here for wait for Donald Trump at 6:30. That's your Power Play Day in politics, though. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones if it's safe. Have a great evening. Thanks for watching.